Yeah.
It's okay.
I'd like to start by dedicating this talk to Ratnashuri, who's my private and public preceptor. And some of you may have heard, Ratnashuri is now, I think, 94. I'm not sure.
95,
thank you. And some of you may have heard that she had a fall just yesterday in her home, and she's now in hospital waiting for a hip operation. She has broken something and needs an operation. She's got friends visiting her, and what we were told in the message this morning is that she's in good spirits. She's a remarkable woman, Ratnashuri, and she is, of course, one of the founding members of this, of Taraloka. She was in the very first community and was here for how many years?
29
years, so she she's far outstripped any longevity that I've had in any one place. Yes, so she was here for 29 years. So she saw Taraloka grow from its very, very beginnings into what it is now. I'm going to mention Ratnashuri as it happens in my talk. Yes, spiritual friendship and the heart's release. I love that expression, the heart's release. And I wanted to start by just saying how much I appreciated the ritual we had last night. That connection with Bhante's blessing, holding the blessed Vishvavajra to our heart. A powerful symbol and quite a weight, and perhaps an unexpected weight as we picked it, as it passed into our hand. The double vajra and the lovely Tara mantra. And it was interesting that when Maitri Devi gave her introduction to the weekend, she said she'd been wondering what has brought us here. And well, it's quite some synchronicity. Because this, I had written quite a bit of my talk by then, and the first thing that I'd written to begin my talk is, why are we all here? So that was, a real sort of synchronicity, hearing Maitri Devi say that last night. And I had various suggestions for why we were all here. The beauty of Taraloka in the summer, the theme of the great love, our friendships with each other, the excitement for our team, those of us leading this retreat, in reviving the great gathering, which has had a very honourable history, lineage, as it were, started by Ratnavandana many years ago. But in a way, I liked Maitri Devi's explanation best, that it was something mysterious that had brought us all here. And I also wanted to ask the question on a deeper level. Why are we here? Why are we in the Tri Ratna community? Why are we Sangha? So, as Maitri Devi said, I've recently moved from Tiruvannamalai, and I've been living the last couple of months in London. I'm in a community house at the LBC, around the LBC, and interestingly, it's the same house that I left 21 years ago, the very same building. I think I might even be in the same room, although I'm a bit hazy about that, but I'm in the room. I'm in Subhadramati's room. Subhadramati's leading the 3-month ordination retreat at this moment, so I was able to be in her room for 3 months. And while I was in the community, I was asked to give, well, when I'm still there for the next month, I was asked to give my life story, which was quite unexpected, actually. I thought, well, I'm only a visitor, I'm not a community member as such. But I was asked to give my life story. And you know, when you give your life story, you remember different aspects of your life in different ways. And I was remembering the time when I was 14. And it was the time, I remember it very vividly, because it was the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. So those of you who are not as old as me may not even know about the Cuban Missile Crisis, or you may know about something to do with a difficult time in history. It was a traumatic time, basically. We, at the school where I was, we were having practices of the, well, in the region, not just the school, we were having air raid warning practices. And we were instructed in the school that if the air raid warning went off, the sirens went off, we had to get under our desks. So it was very real, the danger, the possibility, even the likelihood, it seemed, was very real of a nuclear attack. And yes, there's a very, very good film being made about that occasion. It was the Kennedys that saved the day, actually, it seems. Anyway, that was it, the Cuba Missile Crisis. And probably partly as a result of that, my friends and I, my peer friends at school, growing up into our late teens and early 20s, we didn't really expect to live to be that old. It had seemed such a... you know, the potential of it happening was so real that we thought, well, it could easily happen again. Something like this could easily happen again. And certainly we didn't think we'd live to old age. So here I am, in older age, belying that view that I had. Anyway, yes, so that was... yes, that was what happened when I was 14. And growing up into my late teens and early 20s, the biggest sort of movement in the country, apart from, of course, from Free Love, was the campaign for nuclear disarmament. And many marches up and down the country, and women encircled the Polaris missile base at Greenham Common. Women made a great big circle, holding hands around the whole base, and camped outside the entrance of the base for years, actually, I think it was, in the end. And so I was growing up, and I was preoccupied. Well, when I say preoccupied, I mean I had a teenage life, so I wasn't altogether preoccupied, but I had two questions that kind of recurred, which were more like koans in a way. And the first question was, well, what's the meaning of life? Very common question, I should think, for a teenager. I didn't personally, in my own upbringing, have this, any solace from religion. I wasn't brought up Christian. And the second question, understandably from what I've just recounted, is how do we put an end to war? And there was a sort of rider to that question, that how can we put an end to war unless we can live under the same roof as each other in some kind of harmony? And in some way I knew that they were somehow connected, that putting an end to war had something to do with the meaning of life. So I've had attempts to answer this question. I studied philosophy, thinking that that might help me understand the meaning of life. Then I went and lived on a hippie commune in the west of Ireland, thinking that that might help me understand the meaning of life. Then I travelled in India for a year, thinking that that might help me understand the meaning of life. And then I became part of the women's, what was so-called the women's liberation movement, thinking that that might help me understand the meaning of life. Anyway, it wasn't until I met the Dharma in the form of a meditation class at the LBC when I was 30 that I felt I was on track in some way to begin to answer those questions. So I want to talk now for a little bit about the four reminders or the four mind-turning reflections. Some of you may have come across these. They're part of Mitra study, I believe. And there's a retreat each year, I think, at Taraloka on this theme. And there's one coming up a bit later, which Suchitta will be leading. So, yes, a real opportunity there. So they're a teaching from the Tibetan Buddhist traditions. They're part of what's known as the preliminary practices, which are done before the main meditation practice, to prepare oneself for meditation. And the first of these reminders is to reflect on our precious human birth, our precious human life, that we have been born as human beings, we're alive, we're conscious, with all or most of our faculties. We're living in a society where we're relatively free, and particularly where we're free to practice the Buddha's teachings. All of this might not be the case, so we're really encouraged in this reflection to reflect on that and to reflect on the opportunities that we have. And the reminder that follows, the second reminder, comes as a bit of a shock. That while this life is precious, it is also impermanent. I will die and all will die. The second reflection reminds us that everything is impermanent. My body, this great gathering, Taraloka, whole world systems. Everything arises and ceases to be. Not only will we all die, but none of us can know when that will be. So this reflection is pretty sobering. The third reminder is to reflect on the law of karma, that every action has a consequence, has an effect, for good or for ill. That actions arising out of generosity, love and wisdom bring about happiness, and that actions arising out of greed or craving, ill will and ignorance bring suffering to both ourselves and others. And the fourth reminder is of the defects of samsara. It tells us that samsara, or the world that we create out of ignorance, is defective, is faulty. It's fundamentally unsound in that it leads us to believe that each of us is a separate self that can find security and happiness through having and owning, whether that be possessions or people. Another way of describing this is that when we create samsara, because it's we who create it, you could say that we samsarize. That's how samsara comes into being. We samsarize. That when we create samsara, we are in a relationship to the world of grasper and grasped. So a very evocative way of describing self and other in this sense, grasper and grasped. So these reflections are called the four reminders because we need to be reminded. We're quite capable of going through at least a whole day, if not a whole week, maybe a few months or even years, without ever thinking about any of this. In that way, even actively avoiding such thoughts. Probably most of us here do think about it, maybe once a month at least. And they're also called the four mind-turning reflections because reflecting on these truths does turn our minds to how to live, what is most important in our lives, what are our real priorities. In fact, the first two reflections are sufficient in themselves to prompt us in that way. If our lives are precious, yet inevitably end in death, what does that mean for how we live our lives? So it was an encounter with death which brought about the profound mind turning of the young man Siddhartha, the Buddha to be. I'm sure you all know the story, but it's always worth retelling. His father, fearing a prophecy at birth that his son would become a Siddha, a holy man, was determined to keep him away from the realities of life. He was brought up in a protected, wealthy environment. And there's a beautiful passage which I love reading and hearing in the life of the Buddha. I was delicate, most delicate, supremely delicate. Lily pools were made for me at my father's house solely for my benefit. Blue lilies flowered in one, white lilies in another, red in a third. I used no sandalwood that was not from Benares. My turban, clothes and cloak were all made from Benares cloth. A white sunshade was held over me day and night so that no cold or heat or dust or dew might inconvenience me. I had three palaces, one for the winter, one for the summer, and one for the rains. So having been protectively brought up in luxury, surrounded by sense pleasure, he had the urge for himself to see what lay outside the palace walls. With his trusted charioteer, Chanda, he leaves the palace three times. The first time he sees an old person, the second time a sick person, the third time a corpse. His whole world is turned upside down. And the first sight causes him anxiety. And he says, Thus old age strikes down indiscriminately memory, beauty and valour, and yet with such a sight before its eyes the world is not perturbed. And the prince returned to the palace, but so lost in anxiety that it seemed to him empty. The second sight of sickness causes him depression. This is the calamity of disease for mankind, and yet the world sees it and feels no alarm. Then he turned back with all feeling of joy gone and entered the palace, given over to brooding. And the third sight of a corpse causes him great disturbance. It says he was like a lion pierced deeply in the heart with a poisoned arrow. So unable to remain in the palace, he goes into the surrounding countryside with his closest companions and comes across a ploughed field, the grass all torn and cut and lying in the earth, dead worms, insects and small animals killed by the ploughing. The story relates that seeing this, he felt a deep grief as if it were his own relatives that lay there. And at the same time he sees the worn and weathered bodies of the ploughmen and the distress of the oxen labouring with the effort of drawing the plough. He sees in one moment the suffering inherent in all of life, and the response arises in him of a deep compassion. So, the story is a story, but what it tells us is that however many times he may have seen these sights, this was the first time that he really saw them, saw the implications, that he let them in, allowed them to disrupt his secure and pleasurable existence, the first time that he really deeply questioned the meaning of life. So having been so deeply affected, he feels the need to be alone, he stops his companions from following him, and he goes to the root of a tree. Very interesting how often sitting at the root of the tree occurs in the life of the Buddha. And he reflects on the origin and destruction of all life. And as he reflects, we are told that he becomes free from the three mental intoxications: the intoxication of youth, the intoxication of health, and the intoxication of life. That is, the pride and delusion that he could somehow be immune to all of this, that he is in control and that the world can be organized to keep things secure and to suit oneself. And it is at this point that the fourth sight appears to him. A wandering mendicant, a man who has left the home life in search of truth. In some versions of the story, he sees him without any words passing between them. He just sees the steady way in which he walks, his bearing one of calm and joy, his expression clear and open, with simple clothing, without possessions. In other versions of the story, he tells Siddhartha that he wanders without expectations in search of the highest good. So at the same time as he is shaken to the core by his experience, Siddhartha also has a vision of another way of being. A way of being that embraces the truth of death and suffering, yet embodies freedom, energy, and calm, and a going out into unknown territory, into the mystery of life. His existential crisis turns his mind decisively towards a way of being that he intuits could make sense of both life and death. And he himself is determined to leave home and seek the truth. Then follows 7 years of wandering and intensive spiritual practice before his enlightenment. So for most of us, our mind turning is nowhere near quite as decisive as the story of Siddhartha. But each of us is confronted at some point in our lives by our existential situation. How to live this precious human life. If our minds turn at this point to the potential of another way of being, if we turn, in the words of one writer, from a having to a being mode of existence, from a having mode of existence to a being mode of existence. And if we do this encouraged and inspired by the enlightenment experience of the Buddha and his teachings, the Dharma, then we also enter the Sangha. In other words, we go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. But it's important to realize, as I'm sure you have realized, that the Sangha refuge does not do away with our existential situation. It's not a solution. It's not a panacea. It's not in itself a security. It doesn't take away our experience of aloneness or protect us from the suffering of the human condition. It's a context for practice. It gives encouragement and support. It can give us a depth of friendship in which we are able to be more and more fully ourselves, in which we can be transparent. It gives us companions on the path. And I like this this passage from Chögyam Trungpa, who talks, who's giving a teaching about this existential situation in quite a provocative way. So Chögyam Trungpa was a Tibetan teacher, a Tibetan Buddhist teacher. You probably know that. And he says, your goal is loneliness. Loneliness here is not meant in the sense of feeling alone in an empty room with nothing but a mattress. We are talking about the fundamental starvation of the ego. There are no tricks you can play. There's nothing more you can do about the loneliness at all. So for that reason, there's a need for a teacher, a need for the Sangha, and a need for practice. So, I just quite like the provocative way in which he talks about that. And this is where the mind-turning reflections come in. What is being said here, as I understand it, is that spiritual life and practice enables us to experience rather than avoid our existential situation. Rather than trying to avoid it, that experience is necessary even for us to practice in such a way that we gradually recognize this delusion of a separate ego self and truly experience our interconnectedness. It's this that Siddhartha has a glimpse, or more than a glimpse of, when he sees the dead insects lying in the ploughed field and is flooded with compassion. Insight is not just insight into one's own situation. It connects us with all of humanity. Any deeper realization opens us up to all beings. And at the same time as the Sangha is a supportive context for practice, it's also a ground, a field of practice. Open and honest communication with others, clashes with others, greater awareness of others, empathy with others, tenderness and love for others. All this allows us to weaken our sense of ego self, to see our projections, to be reflected back, and to love more and more deeply and less exclusively. So when I say, way back then when I was 30, that I met the Dharma, what I actually met in my first meditation class was a person. I met the Sangha. So at the interval in the class, a woman came up to me wearing one of these, which I thought was rather odd, and she introduced herself. She looked straight at me, which was rather unnerving, and asked me about myself and how I'd found the meditation, which I thought was slightly, a bit much really, since we'd never met before. I had no idea who she was. And when she discovered I couldn't come to the class the following week, I must say at that time, The meditation was being taught, the mindfulness of breathing was being taught in two stages. So the first evening that you went, you'd learn the first and second stages. You'd be taught the first and second stages of practice. Then you'd come back the next week and you'd get 3 and 4. So I was visiting London at the time from where I was living in Leeds. And so I just said to her, well, I couldn't come back the following week for the rest of the practice. So she offered to write to me and tell me about the rest of the meditation practice we'd been doing. So I gave her my address, but I didn't think twice about it. Until a week or so later, back in Leeds, I received a letter, handwritten letter, wishing me well with the meditations and including a full description of the mindfulness of breathing and the Metta Bhavana, four sides of O4, handwritten. So, yes, this always affects me in the telling of it. My correspondent was a very young Sangha Devi, who became a founder member of Tara Loka and is now a public preceptor. Her name, Sangha Devi, means goddess of the Sangha. So I didn't manage to do the meditations in Leeds. I was working at the time in a women's aid refuge, and it was a very, very intense time, just very intense. I didn't manage to meditate. But I was very affected by the care of this woman, who I'd never met before, keeping her word and taking the time and the trouble to write out the practices for me. A year or so later, I was back in East London. The London Buddhist Centre had opened, so the class that I went to was slightly before the centre opened. And like many others, I felt I'd really come home. What drew me was that gesture of friendliness and care, the Dharma teachings which seemed to point to the meaning of life, and an optional lifestyle of women's communities and team-based businesses where people seemed to be at least having a go at living in harmony together under the same roof. I didn't know the half of it at the time. I was beginning to realize that that in itself was Dharma practice. I also began to understand and to experience more fully that the Dharma which pointed to the meaning of life and the effort to live together harmoniously under the same roof were not separate, even could be mysteriously one and the same. And it was only later that I realized that Sangha Devi had been the fourth site for me. There was also a story that I heard early on in my involvement which stayed with me. You may have heard this before if you've heard one of my talks, because I often talk about it. It was a communication between Bhante and a woman from the Croydon Buddhist Centre who was considering whether or not to become a Mitra. I call it a story because I can't vouch for it definitively being the actual words of the communication. It's a bit like, thus have I heard. I heard this story, so thus have I heard. In order to help her make this decision about whether to become a Mitra, the woman asked Bhante whether there were any stream entrants in the order. In her own mind, presumably, this would be some kind of proof as to whether this movement was the one to really help her develop spiritually and so enable her to make the commitment to becoming a Mitra. Bhante's response was to say that in asking the question in that way, she was putting the cart before the horse. It was rather that in asking to become a Mitra, or even in making a step further, making that commitment to the order and movement, she was helping to create the conditions out of which stream entrance could arise. This response of Bhante's resonated with me strongly. It communicated that the arising of insight and of enlightenment was not a private or a personal affair, but a collective endeavour. It had to do with personal, individual commitment together with Sangha, and this relationship called spiritual friendship, Kalyana Mitrata, which I had yet to really learn more about. So in Tri Ratna, we swim in the Sangha. It's the element in which we practice. We have our chapter meetings, going for refuge groups, order weekends, festival days, class teams, cooking teams, study groups, coolers, gatherings, forums, retreats. You could probably add half a dozen more to that list. And it's easy to take it for granted that the Tri Ratna order and community has a particular emphasis on the importance of friendship, the importance of Sangha, without realizing how truly radical that is. So I'm going to quote something that'll be very familiar to you. I believe that humanity is basically one. I believe that it is possible for any human being to communicate with any other human being, to feel for any other human being, to be friends with any other human being. This is what I truly and deeply believe. This belief is part of my own experience. It is part of my own life. It is part of me. I cannot live without this belief, and I would rather die than give it up. To me, to live means to practice this belief. So that was Sangharakshita speaking in Worli in Bombay many years ago. And as far as I am aware, Tri Ratna is still unique in the Buddhist world in having this emphasis on Sangha and Kalyana Mitra, on spiritual friendship. And this emphasis does not stem from some kind of preference on Bhante's part in founding the order and movement. It rests on a fundamental dharmic truth that all our experience is relational. Our experience happens in terms of subject and object, self and other, and that relational experience is misinterpreted. It's experienced through the veils, the kleshas, of craving, ill will, and ignorance. And that our practice is about purifying that experience, seeing the way things really are. And there's a description of moving, of this process of moving from the unenlightened to the enlightened state in terms of relationship of self and other, which I've always found really helpful. And if you want to look it up, it's on pages 52 and 53 of Know Your Mind. Sangharakshita describes that rather than being able to make a sharp distinction between self and other, subject and object, there is what's called a perceptual situation. You could simply say there is experience, which comprises two opposite poles. At one pole is the experience of what I call myself, together with everything I have under my immediate control. This, he says, is the subjective content of the perceptual situation. At the opposite pole is everything and everyone that is independent of my direct control. This is the objective content of the perceptual situation, the objective content of our in our experience. So it really speaks to me to look at self not just in terms of who or what I think I am, but also in terms of what I think I have control or ownership over. My possessions, my feelings, my views, all this is the subjective content of experience. And Bhante goes on to say, when one becomes enlightened, that perceptual situation still occurs, but one no longer identifies oneself with its subjective content. One no longer identifies oneself with its subjective content, which means that the whole perceptual situation is expanded, clarified, illumined, enlightened. So the issue is not simply that there is inevitably a kind of self-other divide, that reality as we experience it most of the time is bi-tendential, that is, it has two aspects. The issue is that we identify with the subjective pole, that we identify with a self, with what we own, and what we think we have control over. The task, if you like, is to identify as much or more with the objective pole, with other, as with ourselves. It is this which transforms our experience of self and world. I sometimes think of it as embracing what is other. The great love, Mahamaitri, experiences the whole as undivided, responding with equal awareness, care and love. And the passage in Know Your Mind expands on this. When you attain enlightenment, you no longer have a will that is separate from that of others. It's as though you utterly identify with others. You no longer want one thing while they want another, or want something from them that they are unwilling to give. You experience others in a completely different way because your will is not coming into collision with theirs. This completely different, more relaxed, lighter and freer attitude, taken to the nth degree, is something of the nature of enlightenment. The world is the same, but you see it differently. Perhaps one could say that it's like what happens when you fall in love, only much more so. So where does spiritual friendship, Kalyana Mitrata, friendship with the lovely, the beautiful, where does it come into this? Well, I'm going to tell you another story, which I'm sure you know, but it's always worth telling again. So it's the story of Meghia. So the young monk Meghia is a companion and attendant, more accurately, attendant of the Buddha for a period of time. He's returning from his alms round when he passes a delightful mango grove on his way back to where he's living with the Buddha. And immediately he's thinking what a good place it would be to meditate for the day. Shaded and pleasant. No doubt he's also thinking how much progress he'll make in meditation in such a suitable place, maybe even breaking through in that very day to stream entry. So arriving back, he requests permission from the Buddha to leave and to strive in meditation in the mangrove grove, to which the Buddha simply says, "As long as I am alone, Meghia, stay here till another monk comes." But Meghia can't wait. His desire is more important, and he asks again, this time pointing out to Shakyamuni that he, Shakyamuni, has no further need to strive, while Meghia himself has more need to practice. And the Buddha replies the same way. "As long as I am alone, Meghia, stay here till another monk comes." So Meghia asks a third time, again making the comparison, and this time the Buddha says, "As you talk about striving, Meghia, what can I say? Do what you think it is time to do." So Meghia goes off to the mango grove. So maybe the first teaching is beware of asking the Buddha three times. So he goes to the mango grove full of his longing for deepening his practice, and no doubt a longing for attainment. In one translation, he speaks of his need to be confirmed in his own development. And so he leaves the Buddha. And seated in meditation, before long, we are told, he is assailed by evil and unprofitable thoughts, desire for sense experience, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of cruelty. And at the end of the day, somewhat chastened, he reports this back to the Buddha, who responds, "Meghia, when the heart's release is immature, five things conduce to its maturity. Herein, monk, a monk has a lovely intimacy, a lovely friendship, a lovely comradeship. When the heart's release is immature, this is the first thing that conduces to its maturity." The Buddha then describes the other four things which lead to the maturity of the heart's release: the practice of ethics, engaging in discussion and reflection on the Dharma, virya, energy in pursuit of the good, and the development of wisdom, presenting Meghia with the whole path of practice. But it's clear from the sutta that spiritual friendship, Kalyana Mitrata, is not simply one of these five things, but the primary thing and the major condition for the other four. Meghia, when a monk has admirable people as friends, companions, and colleagues, it is to be expected that he will be virtuous. It is to be expected that he will be able to hear without difficulty talk on the Dharma that is conducive to the opening of awareness. It is to be expected that he will keep his persistence aroused for abandoning unskillful qualities and developing skillful qualities. It is to be expected that he will be able to discern arising and passing away, so able to discern conditionality. So it's a beautiful statement, Nagya. When the heart's release is immature, five things conduce to its maturity. Herein, a monk has a lovely intimacy, a lovely friendship, a lovely comradeship. When the heart's release is immature, this is the first thing that conduces to its maturity. So I think this sutta is such a helpful reminder to us of our tendency to chase after experience and to think that we can go it alone. Of course, we will be like Nagya sometimes. We'll be fired up by a particular idea of ourselves or by our competitive natures or by the idea that a certain technique or practice is what will do it for us. But so long as we have good friends who can reflect us back, all that will not be to our detriment. Our good friends will refrain from saying, probably, "I told you so," and listen kindly and challenge us where appropriate. And it is not just the Kalyanamitratta of the Buddha which Nagya needs first and foremost, though clearly he really did not see what riches were immediately in front of him, which is the blindness of immaturity we can perhaps all relate to. Apparently, in 3 out of the 5 translations of the sutta, the term translated as a lovely friendship is in the plural. So it is our lovely friendships which are the primary condition for our spiritual growth. And primary here does not just mean initial condition. The practice of friendship can take us to insight and beyond. It is an aspect of the enlightened mind. The heart's release is the liberation of citta, the heart-mind. It is the expansion of consciousness beyond ego clinging. In its maturity, the heart's release is the spontaneous, compassionate activity of the Bodhisattva, Mahamaitri, the great love. But we come across this exhortation again in the Pali texts. In the Sambodhi Sutta, the Buddha says, "Having admirable companions is the first prerequisite for the development of the wings to self-awakening." In the Chapter of Wands, he says, "I don't envisage any other single factor like admirable friendship as doing so much for a monk in training who has not yet attained the heart's release." And of course, there are the words of the Buddha to Ananda, who has discovered that Kalyanamitratta is half of the spiritual life. "Say not so, Ananda, say not so. Kalyanamitratta is the whole of the spiritual life." And of course, the Buddha is not talking in the abstract. Friendship matters to him. At his parinirvana, when he's dying, he is aware that Ananda is not present. And he asks where Ananda is, and is told that Ananda is outside, weeping. He calls him in, tenderly but clearly tells him that all that arises must cease. And rejoices in his merits, rejoices in his friendship, and affirms his practice. The Buddha is also aware that a stranger has travelled to see him and is waiting outside, not having known of his illness, not knowing what to do. And he calls him in and gives him the refuges. At his parinirvana, weak and in physical pain, he makes sure to ordain him into the order. So in one of the sutras in the Pali Canon, there's a list of the characteristics, the 8 qualities of a spiritual friend. Now, I'm afraid I haven't got all these 8, because I had a bit of a disaster last night, and at 11 o'clock I completely lost my talk. It disappeared off my computer, never to return. And then later on this morning, when I tried to find this on the internet again, which was the 8 qualities of a spiritual friend, the internet was down at Taraloka. So I've remembered 5 of them. But there are 8, and I'm sure the others will come back to me at some point. So 5 of these characteristics are faith, Shraddha, faith, Shraddha, generosity, Virya, meditation in the sense of samadhi, and wisdom, or wise intelligence, you might say. So what's clear from this description of these qualities is that we're not talking here about friendship as personality attraction, or intensity, or intoxication, or being best buddies. Perhaps spiritual friendship is best described as being able to be that fourth sight for each other. When we can be that fourth sight for each other, which may of course be intermittent, great things are possible. We don't need to be perfect, we just need to be good enough and have commitment to that good enough becoming better. I just wanted to add, by the way, that I'm very keen on this expression, good enough. Sri Ratna can be good enough. Our teacher can be good enough. The Sangha can be good enough. We don't need to be perfect. We just need to be good enough and have commitment to that good becoming better. And to make that Sangha a perfect context for the spiritual life. Well, what I mean to say is, with commitment, that good enough Sangha is a perfect context for the spiritual life. So yes, being that fourth sight for each other, great things are possible, both collectively and individually. And one of those great things is right here, Taraloka. The commitment to spiritual friendship of Ratnasuri, Sangadevi, and Kulanandi, which made Taraloka possible. Many people, of course, contributed to its coming into being, raised money, worked here, did all sorts of things. But it was they who were willing to leave the hub of the FWBO as it was then and break out into the unknown to live in a drafty farmhouse together, surrounded by ruined barns and rough fields. So different from each other. Ratnasuri in her 60s, ebullient and talkative. Sangadevi in her early 30s, having quite an English reserve. Kulanandi, a Mitra at the time, joining them. All of them living off Ratnasuri's old age pension. Any other income was needed to restore the building sufficiently to start retreats. And Ratnasuri, I've heard since, cooked on a camping stove for the community and for the work retreats and other retreats that followed until they managed to buy a cooker. Yeah. And I could add, impromptu addition. Great things are possible collectively and individually right now at Taraloka with the community sitting here in this room. Yeah. In a talk that she gave on the international retreat last year, Dhamma Megha evoked a beautiful image of a reservoir of skillfulness, wisdom and virtue that we create together through our actions of body, speech and mind in the Sangha. And that the Sangha is the Dharma to the degree that we are living this gathering of wisdom and acting more and more in accord with the way things are. And the more we do this together, the more we are the fourth sight for each other, the more that Maha Maitri, great love, can emerge within our Sangha, so that it becomes Sanghakaya, the Sangha body of the Buddha. So I'm going to finish with a reading extolling this great love from the Vimalakirti Nidesha Sutra. So it's extracted, it's not the whole passage. So you may, if you know this passage, you may realize that some bits are missing because it's quite long. And I've changed the gender pronouns for the benefit of us here and now. Vimalakirti replied, Manjushri, when a bodhisattva considers all living beings in this way, she thinks, just as I have realized the Dharma, so should I teach it to living beings. Thereby, she generates the love that is truly a refuge for all living beings. The love that is peaceful because free of grasping. The love that is not feverish because free of the passions. The love that accords with reality because it is equanimous. The love that is without conflict because free of the violence of the passions. She generates the love that is firm, its high resolve unbreakable like a diamond. The love that is pure, purified in its intrinsic nature. The saint's love that has eliminated its enemy. The Buddha's love that causes living beings to awaken from their sleep. The love that has no presumption because it has eliminated attachment and aversion. The love that is never exhausted because it acknowledges voidness and selflessness. The love that is giving. The love that is tolerance because it protects both self and others. The love that is effort, because it takes responsibility towards all living beings. The love that is contemplation, because it refrains from indulgence in tastes. The love that is liberative technique, because it shows the way everywhere. The love that is without formality, because it is pure in motivation. The love that is without deviation, because it acts from decisive motivation. The love that is without deceit, because it is not artificial. The love that is happiness, because it introduces living beings to the happiness of the Buddhas.